Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Dr. Nikazi Oates, the host of the channel. J.J. Johnson joins me to talk about the simple art of rice, recipes from around the world for the heart of your table, which the New York Times named one of the best cookbooks of 2023. He is the chef and founder of Field Trip, a restaurant in Harlem. He is also the host of Just Eats with Chef JJ on Cleo TV and has been featured on Netflix, HBO Max, and Forbes 30 Under 30. JJ, welcome to New Books.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to be a chef?
I was inspired from my grandmother's kitchen. As a young kid, I was about 6 years old. Told my parents at a really young age I was going to be a chef. And the inspiration really is that my grandmother, my great-great-aunts made cooking really fun. And I was like, oh, this is what cooking is. This is what I want to do. Not knowing it was one of the hardest industries in the world. The one thing that I was taught at a young age is that you can put smiles on people's faces through food. And that brings a lot of joy to what I do.
I love that. So you mentioned it's one of the hardest industries in the world. Can we talk a little bit about this? One of my questions that I ask every guest is to share with our listeners a time during your career in which you had a moment of self-doubt, but then also think about a moment of triumph, a moment in which you overcame something.
It's the hardest industry in the world. I'll start there is because it's still a blue-collar industry, right? As many chefs as we see on television today, it's 50, 60, maybe 100 chefs you might see on TV at the most, you know? And that's maybe worldwide. It's still a blue-collar industry. People wake up every day, get paid a minimum wage to satisfy folks that are looked down on, right? The dishwasher, the porter, the line cook. That's not a job that you walk around with your chest pumping. You want to walk around with your chest pumping, but society looks down on it. So I think the triumph moment for me is giving people a safe space to work in, a space where they can have some type of livable wage to support their family and give people delicious food. And that the folks I work at Field Trip, my restaurant, or any of the restaurants I work in, can walk out the doors with their chest proud and say, oh, I'm the porter here, or I'm the chef here, and nobody's going to look down on them because they know what we stand for. They know the impact in the communities we have. They know who the people are behind the doors or the walls. And those folks that work in those restaurants are just more than line cooks or more than dishwashers or more than chefs. They're community leaders. They're people that look out for you in the street. They're ones that will help you in need. That's how I hope people look at the folks that work in my restaurants.
And did you have a moment of self-doubt that you want to share?
I had a moment of self-doubt in culinary school. I was the worst person in my class. I call my dad and I say to him, hey man, I'm going to quit. I'm out of here. He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, you've been telling us your whole life you're going to cook. You're going to be a chef. And now you're going to quit? After all that fighting with your mother all those years? Is he going to just pack it up and go? He's like, no, I'm not going to let you quit. Like, you can't quit. You're not allowed to. And really pushed me through that first 6 months of culinary school when I was like, this wasn't a place for me.
Do you recall his voice in moments when you are at your restaurant or catering?
Yeah. During the pandemic, you know, I can recall his voice saying, times for Black people are always hard. This is another time. Right? So would you gonna close the restaurant doors? You can't do that. That's not allowed. Can't do what these other folks are doing. What you gonna do? You won't have no restaurant, right? So, and I think having folks like that, if it's not your parents or your loved ones, it can be your friends, it can be a mentor. I think having folks like that have that voice in the back of your mind that can push you through, could feel like the voice that gets you through doubt. And I think that's necessary for anybody that tries to perform at the high level, if it's in sports or if it's a surgeon or if it's a chef or founder, entrepreneur, a nurse, a teacher, right? Anybody that's performing at the high level has moments of doubt because they believe, is this the right thing to do? Are they doing the right thing? Are they teaching the right thing? Did they walk down the wrong yellow brick road? Those things are necessary.
How did your restaurant survive the pandemic? I came across some statistic that said about a third of all restaurants had to close because of the pandemic. You have a thriving restaurant. How were you able to shift course during the early days of the pandemic?
We just started feeding folks. My wife is a nurse. She gave me the idea. She came home hungry. We fed her. I fed her. Fed her hospital the next day. And I was like, if this beautiful hospital she works in, the nurses have no time to eat or nobody's thinking about them, what about like right here in Uptown? And we went to Harlem Hospital and fed about 40 folks. And it was probably the greatest thing I ever did because I felt like the direct impact. I think a lot of folks in today's society want to feel direct impact, right? They donate money to this foundation or they sit on the board or they do this. And then they're like, did I really do something? And that moment was like direct impact. And I was like, okay, I can do more of this. Like, I have all this food in our fridge with only minimal people walking in. Why am I going to let this food go bad? Let's cook this. And then that turned into a buy a bowl program. And that then led to really, I think, bringing awareness to Field Trip. People were like, oh, we're going to support this place. We're going to make sure that this doesn't go out of business.
There's community support and making sure that one, you fed your community in Harlem, and then two, in turn, they did what they can to say, we have to support this restaurant. I want to talk about The Simple Art of Rice. How did that book come about?
I have a love for rice. I think it's the greatest ingredient in the world. I think it connects us all. And it's like the most disrespected ingredient. It just gets no street cred. And I'm like, it's on everybody's table. People are like, oh man, rice again. Oh man, I don't know how to cook this rice. And I wanted people to be like, yo, rice is simple. It's easy. It helps you. It guides you. It tells stories. It's not biased. It shows you love back, right? It doesn't want to be disturbed at times. And it has a rich history in American culture that people don't want to talk about because it gets into slave trade and colonizers and all this stuff. It's part of America's agriculture system. That's why the nation's so rich. We touch on a lot of that in the book, but also the goal of the book was like, if you just take the first couple pages and you want to make good rice now, it will teach you how to make the perfect pot of rice and you'll be all right. You don't even have to go to the next pages. And if you conquer the perfect pot of rice, then you feel comfortable going to make paella or going to make Korean fried rice or going to make bibimbap or going to make arroz con gandules or going to make, you know, gumbo. You feel comfortable. When you make rice, you make so much of it, you don't know what to do with it the next couple of days. That's what the book also helps you do.
Yeah, you mentioned that it's the most disrespected ingredient, and you were trained at a renowned cooking institute, and you worked under the tutelage of some of the top New York City chefs, and rice was not treated seriously, both for its like technique as well as its sophistication as a food menu item. You also wrote in the book, quote, "So why on earth was rice not on the main menu? At some point, did someone decide that it wouldn't sell in restaurants? How did pasta, bread, potatoes become considered more elevated fare than rice? What do you believe is the reason why rice is devalued?"
Oh, it's devalued because it comes from people of color's communities. It comes from immigrants and migrants.
Mm.
It comes from slavery. It comes from West Africa. So when rice was a cash crop, it was on the table. That's why Thomas Jefferson put Jefferson in front of red rice. And that red rice was on the table. It was in restaurants. It was in hotels at one point because it was a cash crop. People made a lot of money off it, like cotton. The moment enslaved people became free, rice was then not a cash crop anymore because nobody knew how to grow rice at that level. And then it was devalued. Listen how the media talks about it. It makes you bloated. It gains weight. It has gluten. When did rice ever have gluten?
Mm-hmm.
It's not good for you. Oh, man, it has arsenic, right? The media constantly in today's world, even today's society, is constantly beating it up. And then you then look at where the people who like rice or love rice come from. Mexicans, South Americans, Latinos, Southeast Asians, China, right? Japanese has been the only culture that's been like reclaimed the rice on their own and said, hey, you can look at rice however you want to look at it in this country. But in our country, we grow 200 grains of rice. We have rice sommeliers. There's levels to the rice, right? And sushi's looked at like this as a la creme of la creme. So then it's like, ooh, we want to know the rice grain. And the Japanese people have done that well. But everywhere else, when you think about rice, it's, oh man, I'll get the rice. Yeah, I'll get that rice from the food truck. And that rice on the food truck could be the best rice somebody's ever had, but it would never be on a 3 Michelin star table or a fine dining table or the best restaurant in the world. You're starting to see it now, a restaurant here, a restaurant there, because they're cultural driven restaurants, but nobody else is putting rice on the table.
Mm-hmm. And part of the preparation of this book, you've visited a number of rice farms in the Hudson Valley, the American South, and the Indian Himalayas. What did you learn from visiting those places, and what did you find that they all had in common?
There are generations on generations. This isn't like I'm a rice farmer today. It's like, no, my great-great-great-grandfather was a rice farmer.
Hmm.
And then the family passed it down and passed it down, and the next generation took it over. And nobody in the family ever was like, oh, I ain't going to be no rice farmer. It was like, oh, this is a family business. We're going to keep this going. Somebody has to be the rice farmer. And that's what I learned in the Himalayas of India, where like it's 9 generations of a rice farmer. So whoever stayed back at home to be a rice farmer didn't live below everybody else in the world. So if your brother was a doctor or your sister was a lawyer, you had to contribute money back to ensure that the person who stayed home to keep the family rice business going lived at the same level. And what happens with that? That means the family business keeps going. We're all rice farmers. We just happen to be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever we do. What is the backbone of who we are? If anything hits the fan, we all could come back here and keep this business going, because this business also makes a lot of money too.
Mm-hmm. You write in the book, quote, "How you cook rice is a mother tongue passed on from generation to generation, sometimes picking up new expressions, sometimes preserving ancestral idioms." JJ, what are your earliest memories with rice?
My earliest memories with rice was in two kitchens. One is my Puerto Rican grandmother's kitchen, and one's my Southern grandmother's kitchen. And rice was on that table. They were somebody who was always washing rice. It was always simmering low. It was always really good, fluffy. Something was getting poured on top, maybe getting injected with some other type of flavor. But I can't recall a meal at a young age that did not have rice on the table. It was special. People would fight over the rice they put on the table. And I can feel it and see it as I'm speaking to you.
As you were speaking about your two grandmothers, one of the central things that happened in their kitchens is that music played a role in food preparation. And one of your grandmothers played salsa while she was making sofrito and plantain dumplings, and your other grandmother played Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson and Earth, Wind, and Fire as she made cherry pies. I wonder, what music do you listen to when you cook, specifically rice?
I have young kids, so they're always trying to throw that kids bop on me. But, you know,
make you laugh.
But I think the kitchen is, for me, what I learned was this like two-prong effect where you learn about culture or you learn about your culture in the kitchen, and you also learn about the culture of your music. So I'm always playing something. And it's so interesting. I see videos of like young kids dancing to like 90s music these days. And I'm like, 90s music isn't that so far. It's not that long ago.
No.
But, you know, that's the music. This is the same thing our parents and our grandparents did to us. So like my mom or my mother-in-law, when they're cooking, they're playing the music of their era, right? And when I'm cooking, I'm playing the music in my era. So I'm constantly playing like R&B music around my kids. They're listening to Usher. They're listening to Michael Jackson. They're definitely listening to some like hip hop music that doesn't have any curse words in it. But my kids love music. And I'm also playing music from my parents' era that is touching them and they're singing along to. So they're definitely listening to Beyonce.
And speaking of music and food, you worked for Alexander Smalls.
Yeah.
In his restaurant. And things changed when you worked at that restaurant. So can you tell us a bit about that experience? And for our listeners who may be unfamiliar with Mr. Smalls, can you tell them a bit about who he is?
Alexander Smalls is a prolific person. He is known for his restaurant, Cafe Beulah. He's won Tony Award for Porgy and Bess. He's written cookbooks. He is a walking encyclopedia. He's a tastemaker. And he's the first person to ever give me a shot to run a kitchen. Nobody ever wanted to put my name at the helm. And he was the first person to give me a shot to run the Cecil as his chef de cuisine. We went to Ghana together, where I found myself. But at one point in my career and in my personal life, he was a prominent figure that I was around a lot, probably from 2010, 11 to 2017, 16. I've cooked dinners in Alexander's homes. I've met all of his friends. I've been kicked out of his home, almost kicked out of his home by one of his friends. I've traveled with him to the Hamptons. We developed Afro-Asian American cooking together, which was really his idea. He's had a major impact on the food industry in a very like non-traditional way. He's not a classically trained chef, but he understands food and culture and people. And he always loves a glass of bourbon with a little bit of tea in it.
And when you worked at the Cecil back in 2014, Esquire magazine named it as one of the best new restaurants in America, in large part because of you. The food critic said to Mr. Smalls, unfortunately, that you won't get the credit. He pretty much gave a nod to you, and he was just like, well, I don't necessarily need to be the person cooking the food. It's important that the food is remembered, and that speaks to your culinary abilities.
I think when people are creating restaurants, there's a bunch of different folks, right? Somebody who can write the checks, right? Make sure you open it. There's a curator, and then there's a chef, right? Sometimes a chef is a curator. Sometimes a curator is a chef. Alexander Smalls would always say about me is like, if you work with JJ or you do something with JJ, he's going to own it as much as you own it. And I think that's why we had a really great partnership during that era. You look at restaurants today and you go back 10 years to when the Cecil started, you can see the impact Cecil has had across the globe. Like nobody was cooking Afro-Asian American cooking. Mm-hmm. Nobody was even cooking food of the diaspora at that level. There was restaurants, but nobody was writing about them. Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing them everywhere, right? That's what Alexander did. He made people remember it so much that they had to start figuring out how to create it, which is something special.
And working at the Cecil, as you point out, but I just want to draw it out a bit more, you accompanied him on the trip to Ghana. Was that the spark for conceiving Field Trip?
I think that was a spark for me of what I was going to cook for the rest of my life. Like before then, I was cooking very Eurocentric food, risotto, because that's what I was taught in culinary school. When I went to Ghana, I started figuring out who I was. Like, oh, I could express my grandmother's kitchen. Oh, I could put that spice on a plate. And when Alexander first came to me, he talked about Afro-Asian American cooking. I had no idea what he was talking about. Not realizing that's who I was, right? Or a lot of people are. And yes, it was an initial spark for the love of rice, because that's when I initially started to fall back in love with rice again. But yeah, Ghana did a lot for me.
What do people get wrong about rice?
People don't realize you got to wash the rice. That's one. A lot of people get that wrong. Number two is the rice doubles in size. So you need the right size pot for the rice to grow. And rice is not like pasta. It doesn't want to be stirred. It wants to be put in a pot with the liquid, put the top on, let it chill. It's like one of those friends that you have that you're like, yo, you're like the chillest cat in the room. You don't really want to talk to everybody, but everybody want to talk to you. That's rice. Like, just let it be. Mm-hmm. You could talk to me when it's done.
In the early parts of The Simple Art of Rice, you have like the fundamentals of rice cooking. One of the things that I did not know, and I would love for you to speak on this, is that you salt rice after it's cooked?
Yes, because you want the rice grain to burst, right? And when you put the salt in the water, it kind of closes up. Think about like an egg yolk. If you add salt to the egg yolk, it gets firm so that when you cook a sunny up egg, the yolk doesn't burst. It's the same thing with rice. You want to put the salt in at the end. I'm not saying like you can put the spices in there, toast the spices, but when you fluff the rice, that's when you put in the salt.
I never knew that.
Trust me. Just do it.
I never knew that.
You let me know.
I will. If you had to just use one sense to know when rice is done, would it be sight or taste?
Wow. I would say you need to sight is first.
Are there differences between rice cooked on the stovetop or in the oven or in a rice cooker? Or which one yields the best results?
I think if you're uncomfortable cooking rice, you should start off with the rice cooker and then move to the stovetop. If you have a lot of items going on the stovetop that day, then you can cook rice in the oven. Because you're so comfortable with rice that you know that it'll come out perfectly okay.
How did your grandmothers cook rice? Did they cook it on the stovetop? Did they cook it in the oven?
My southern grandmother cooked it on the stovetop and in the oven. My Puerto Rican grandmother cooked it on the stove.
And how do you cook rice?
I cook it so many ways. I cook it on the stovetop, in the oven, in a rice cooker.
You have a rice cooker?
Yeah. I steam rice. I pop it like popcorn. There's so many different things that I do to rice.
Is one technique better than the other when cooking brown rice? In technique, again, I'm talking about the stovetop, the oven.
For me, brown rice, you use a stovetop or a rice cooker.
Okay. I made one of your recipes this week, the herbed brown rice. And I must admit, I always make rice on the stovetop. And right. So I made your herb brown rice and it was delicious. Let me just tell our audience what the herbs were. They were thyme, rosemary, oregano, cilantro, and Italian parsley. I have been raving about this rice dish to like everyone, to my colleagues, to my friends. And I'm a pretty good cook. Let me just say that. I'm not trained, okay? I'm not trained. I have certain people in my family, like my mother, but I'm not. I do like to cook. When I go visit certain friends, I am like the designated cook, and which is great in a lot of ways because I'm able to like just create new dishes or successful dishes that I make at home. I then tell them about it and they say, oh, you have to make this when you come see me. And so there's this expectation that I have to make it. And I do. When it came to the herb brown rice, I said, oh my gosh, I have to make this for you. And they said, well, send me the recipe. And I'm like, well, you got to buy the book, but I'll make this for you. So I made this and delicious.
Thank you.
I want to talk about like some of the rice recipes that you have in addition to the one that I made. You have a section in the book on brunch, and there are recipes in there such as rice waffles or crepes. How did you get the idea to incorporate rice into those dishes?
Well, the rice crepe, that was definitely something on me. Using rice flour for people that have a gluten allergy or that don't want to use as much flour, that's where I got the rice crepes from. And also like being in the kitchen, testing a lot of stuff. There's rice flour around, being with my kids, trying stuff out. And that's how that came about. The rice waffles is a, you know, South Carolina, North Carolina, Southerner thing. We use the leftover rice and throw it into your waffles. So that was an homage to the culture and showing that rice is versatile, that you can have leftover rice and you can use it in many different ways. And that's the greatest thing about rice. You can use it in any place, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, side, main course, afterthought.
Which recipes were from your family's archive that were in the book?
My grandmother's soupy, BB soupy rice, my grandfather's Mississippi gumbo, Auntie Lane's curry rice. You know, those I would say were the top three that we put in there.
Mm. Did you adapt them for the book? And if so, how did you?
You know, they write stuff down on paper or you remember a little pinch. And, you know, I, myself as a chef, I've been through their notes and have talked to them on the phone at points, writing down notes and then developed it, memory, taste, look, family members. That's how we got it. I think for me, the greatest thing was being able to tell their story in the book. So many folks should realize who I am, what my foundation is, all that stuff.
JJ, so besides mastering the art of rice, what technique should everyone, regardless of skill, master?
That's a hard one. In the kitchen? Oof, that's a hard one. I think the mastering of one of one skill, I would tell you, is searing. And it's making sure the pan is smoking before you add the oil. Because everybody wants to sear. Everybody wants the steak to be caramelized or the fish to be golden brown or the saute the onions. And most of us add the oil into the pan before it's hot. And the goal is let the pan smoke, then add the oil, then cook. And if you master that, you will cook so much better.
Before we end, I just want to go back to talk a little bit more about the history of rice. As far back as you can go, what's the earliest agricultural history of rice?
I think the earliest agricultural part of rice is two places is West Africa, Glamorimo Rize. That's the pivotal point of rice, right? West Africa was known for rice, producing rice for the world before climate change in that era came in effect, and they had to give it to Asia to help produce the rice, aka getting blacklisted. There's no water, all these things going on. And then I would say with the native people of America, it was wild rice. And most people don't want to say wild rice is rice, but rice is a grass. Wild rice is a grass. Wild rice is rice. So I would say those are the two, you know, foundational points of rice. Glamorimo Rize is the mother grains or the grandmother grains of all rice. There's two yellow brick roads at one point. And then wild rice, because it's native to America. Rice came through slave trade into America, braided in people's clothing and hair. Rice came through the Americas that way.
So before we go, JJ, tell us what you are working on now. Is there another cookbook that you have in mind?
I'm always cooking. I'm always cooking up something. I think the one thing you'll learn is from me, I'm always working on something. And if something pops up, I wasn't working on it yesterday and it just happened. I could have been working on it for 5 years, could be working on it for a year. Definitely we'll see a book in the mix over the next 2 years. Definitely we'll see some restaurants, always focused on field trip and growing that brand. And the goal is just for me, to hopefully one day be a household name where you could cook out of my pots and pans, read my books, watch me on TV, eat out of my restaurants. You rocking with JJ all day.
So we look forward to how you would take over the industry. JJ Johnson is chef and founder of Field Trip, a restaurant in Harlem. He is the author of the cookbook, The Simple Art of Rice, Recipes from Around the World for the Heart of Your Table, which the New York Times named one of the best cookbooks of 2023. The Simple Art of Rice is published by Flatiron Books. JJ, I want to thank you so much for being on the show.
No, thank you for having me. This was a blast.